Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, ladies. Thank you all for joining us again. This third installment. So, so we'll finish up the Shita Muksa tonight, and then the next time we meet, let's put it that way, and I'll remind you in email, I like to do that activity that I mentioned in the beginning, which is to bring in five items, any five items, and we'll just all sit around. There's a perfect table set up for that purpose, and we'll all try and decide what category in Muksa those items find themselves in.
We each bring in five.
So yeah, everyone please bring in five. Remember what you bring. The next class, whenever the next class is, if everyone could please bring in five, we won't... And just make, you know, just keep an eye on your own stuff so that we can take some of the learning and apply it a little bit more and have a discussion. And I think we'll see, as we touched on last week, that one person's B may be another person's C, for example. It's not necessarily something which is totally objective and totally fixed. It is very much dependent on the individual. So we'll do that next time. Then there's another small unit, shorter even than Muksa, about the importance and centrality of Shabbos and Shabbos observance. We'll touch on that for a couple classes. Then we'll break for winter break for 2 weeks. 2 Mondays we'll be out for winter break. And then we'll meet back again January 7th, when we will start into the introduction to the Lama Test Malachos, the meat and potatoes, if you will, of Hilchos Shabbos. And, go from there. Certainly, if anyone... You know, please do nudge, guilt, whatever methodology you need to get other folks to join us. It's a wonderful thing that we're all learning, and that we're all, our Shabbos observance, hopefully all of us, is being enriched. So January 7th would be a great time. If someone wants to join, that would be a great time for them to jump in. Okay, as an opening piece, as we've done the last couple of times, I'd like to share with you a topic of hashkafa, a topic of attitudes or outlooks on halacha and Torah in general. And the topic I'd like to touch on tonight, it's a big topic, but just to touch on it, is the topic of Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, which really is the topic of arguments, disagreements in Torah, in halacha. And you, I'm sure, well know that there are many of them. There are many, many disagreements, many different ways of looking at different topics and different issues, and it is often confusing. If this is what God told Moshe at Sinai, so how in the world could there be 2 different approaches, 3 different approaches, 10 different approaches sometimes to any particular issue? So this is a big topic. It's a broad topic. Books have been written about this one topic, and we're certainly not going to cover it in depth. But I do want to share with you just a little piece, maybe at other classes we'll touch on it further. This topic is discussed by Rav Dessler, who discusses many, many in the 5-volume work written really by his students. He discusses many, many very important and basic Jewish philosophy type issues. And in this set, which I have a couple of copies of, a couple of volumes right here, he discusses this topic. And he says, and again, ignoring the question for now, how we got from Moshe Rabbeinu hearing it from God on Sinai to 1,000 years or whatever later, rabbis arguing about different things. It's the whole, you know, how that happened, how that transpired, and how certain things were forgotten or certain things weren't clearly delineated to Moshe. That's a whole different topic. But the bottom line is, we have arguments. And those arguments, ladies, he explains, are very often a manifestation of the people involved in those arguments. What that means is that Hashem gifts each and every one of us with different character traits, and a different mix, a different mesh, a different blend of character traits in our persona, in our personality. And those are gifts. Those are gifts from Hashem. And those provide us with our strength and, of course, with our challenges. So that when a Torah giant learns Torah, and that Torah is the material, is the idea that he got from his teacher, who got from his teacher, who got it from Moshe Rabbeinu, and today from the Sfarim that we have, the books that we have, it's not just the material the value neutral material, but it's also their midos. It's also their God-given character traits, which those are filtered through. And therefore, the conclusions that two people looking at the same material can come to can be quite different. And that's not an error. That's not a mistake. That's not oops. That's exactly what Hashem had in mind. He wants those two people to come to somewhat different conclusions, as long, of course, as they are both coming from Torah, as long as they're using the tools that the Torah gives one to use, the conclusions that they have can be different, sometimes very different, and yet they're both true. And that's what that saying means. Elu ve'elu, these and those are the words of the living God, because when a Hillel, in our example in a moment, and a Shammai see the same idea, and they come out with different conclusions, that's because they're looking at it through a different lens, through a different prism. Rabbi Dessler goes on to explain, coming up the week or so to the holiday, the Yom Tov, the Chag of Hanukkah. So there's a famous argument between Hillel and Shammai about how you're supposed to light. How is one supposed to light the Hanukkah candles? Is one supposed to light 1, 2, 3, going all the way up to 8, which of course is our custom? Or is one supposed to do the opposite, much less well-known opinion and position, of lighting 8 the first night, going down to 1 the last night? This is an argument in the Gemara, in Shabbos, where the halachos of Hanukkah are discussed. So Hillel is of the opinion, and we almost always follow Hillel, that you start with 1 and you go up. That's the concept of Ma'alin, Be'kodesh, Ver'ein, Meridin. We increase the holiness, we don't go down. And Shammai says, no, that's not what they, when the rabbis, when the sages of the times of Hanukkah instituted the mitzvah of lighting, they instituted it going down, down from 8 down to 1. So what is their argument? So Rabbi Dessler explains beautifully that Hillel is the character trait of Chesed. Chesed is looking at things as positively as possible, with the potential, the most potential as possible, not so much looking at what is, but looking more at what could be. Shammai, on the other hand, is Gevura. Shammai, on the other hand, is Din. Shammai is what's going on here. The potential is not as important to Shammai as what truly is going on in front of us. And we see this time and time again. You'll recall we're going through the Parshios of Bereishis. This is reflected first and foremost by Avraham, who is Chesed, and by Yitzchak, who is Gevura, different character traits. It's a long, long conversation, fascinating conversation. But those are two basic character traits. So Hillel says, you light one the first night, and you increase. Because even though we may be more excited about the Yom Tov, any Yom Tov, at the beginning, or any experience for that matter, any gift, anything, at the very beginning, and that unfortunately tends to taper as time goes forward, that's not the ideal. The ideal of the greats of tzaddikim is to grow with their excitement, to grow with their learning and the holiness that they experience in any given opportunity. So that the potential is to go from 1 to 8. Ma'alim b'kodesh ve'im arid. And we go up in holiness, we don't go down. Is it true? No, maybe not. It may not be a reality, but it's the potential. It's what we hope for and what we wish for and what we pray for. And Shammai says the exact opposite. Who are you fooling? Hanukkah, all experiences start off really exciting, and the kids are excited, and the parents are excited, and everything's great at the very beginning. But by the end, you know, it's time to put away the Hanukkah already. Let's go back to life. Interrupts our schedule. You know, we all have our reasons to get on with the next phase. So Hillel says, no, in our behavior, we have to focus on what could be. The fact is not true? Okay, that's secondary. Shammai says, no, if you delude yourself, if you fool yourself in your behavior, then that could be self-sabotaging. That could be a negative influence. You've got to be realistic and remind yourself always you're not where you want to be. So that's just one, I think, very important fundamental argument, and obviously that type of outlook can affect all of life. But that's one example of an argument between two Torah greats. They sat on the same Beit Din, they were friends, they were colleagues, they have discussions regularly throughout the Gemara. They take different approaches. They are both viewed as right, they're both viewed as true, they're both viewed as critical, as important, they're both recorded forever. We study both sides, even though we follow Hillel. We follow Hillel almost always. And there are many, many, many examples of this. We follow Hillel's approach of potential and don't worry so much about what is, look more about what could be. We follow Hillel in many, many different areas of halacha. So that's an example of where we don't necessarily ourselves understand or appreciate the other opinion, but they're both true, and Hashem sees them as both true, or three opinions, or four opinions, or whatever, what have you, and it's important for us to appreciate that. As long as they're following halacha and they're using the tools that God gave us, they're both right. The question we have to grapple with is, who do we follow? So this, I think, helps explain very often when we hear things that are not necessarily in keeping with what we've been taught, and not necessarily in keeping with what we've seen. Sometimes you'll see this, for example, between the approach of American Torah Jewry sometimes and Israeli Torah Jewry. There are many exceptions, but very often you'll see that there's an Israeli approach which is sometimes more strict, sometimes more demanding than the American approach. That's a gross overstatement, but there's many examples of this where different communities, Hasidim and Misnagdim, take up different stringencies and leniencies in different areas. So we should all grow and mature in our understanding of this, that just because someone does something different than I do doesn't make them better or worse necessarily. As long as both customs, both approaches are within Torah, they're both acceptable, they're both cherished. The 12 tribes, the 12 sons of Yaakov, each had different strengths and different areas where they were stronger and they're accented. So this is an important understanding, I think. So if I say something here which is different, more lenient, more strict than somewhere else, I encourage you to explore that, to think about that, to figure out which approach you want to take. That's sometimes a very difficult thing to do. I know in Tamima I always issue a disclaimer at the beginning of every year that if your parents follow a different approach, then you should follow your parents. That way I kept myself out of trouble. So that's it's. I remember going to yeshiva. I was 18 years old, and finally looking forward, I'll be in Israel in yeshiva, and I'll get everything straight, and I'll figure out the science of halacha and what. And I came back, and I was sitting with my rebbe, Rabbi Daniel Estreicher Shlita, and I complained to him that that's not the way it is. And he said, "Welcome to the you're a big boy now. You know, welcome to the real world. That's not really the way it is. It's simply not." So halacha can sometimes be more confusing. Is more sometimes there's science and art, like in many things in life. So please feel free, privately or in class during the Q&A, to ask if you've heard things differently. It's certainly not monolithic. One other brief thought, we can talk more about this later, but that is also that the halacha can in fact be different for two people because of who they are. What I mean by that is not just Ashkenazi, Sephardi, and all the other different Hasidim, etc., but there's also levels of expectation, levels of observance. What I mean by that is there is the halacha, so that our goal in life is to keep the halacha. I don't mean short-circuiting, taking shortcuts in halacha, but within the halacha itself, there are many areas where the halacha will say, for example, bal nefesh yachmir al atzma, which means someone who's a bal nefesh, very hard to translate, but someone who's on a higher level, very bad translation, should be more strict. There's a variety of different examples of that, but the bottom line is, if one sees, the certain stringencies, for example, that maybe one should not keep, and this is has a lot to do with congruency, meaning our goal in life, and in all of life really, is to be somewhat congruent. We're never exactly congruent because we're people, but we try to be somewhat congruent so that you don't want your observance to be way out of whack where you're super, 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 super strict on one thing and totally ignoring another. Our observance and our growth should try in some ways to be congruent, which also again explains why some people will keep certain stringencies that other people don't and shouldn't. It's really not necessarily appropriate for that person to try to take on that stringency. So again, that's opening a whole other, Pandora's box. That's a whole other conversation. But I just want to mention that because I think it is, again, confusing to a lot of people. When we learn halacha, it's exactly where we find ourselves and exactly where we should be. Okay, so going now to halacha, ladies. We talked last week, one of the big topics was about Migu. This was page 2, just to touch on this for a moment. And the concept of Migu was that the status that something has at sunset, the Friday night, is the status that it has the entire Shabbos. So that if it's Muksa at Shkia, and Muksa at sunset Friday afternoon, these days it's like 5:30, it remains Muksa the entire Shabbos, even if somehow that status would have otherwise changed. So one of the examples that we gave, which I think was a little confusing to some folks, was the cholent example, was food. Food that's not ready, that's not fully cooked, we said is not Muksa, because you and I eat cholent. So it turns out that actually, I'd forgotten this Gemara, but the Gemara actually asks that very question. The Gemara says, if you accept the concept of Migu, that the status something has, sunset, is the status that it has the whole Shabbos, that means you can't eat food. Any uncooked food is Muksa, is off limits. So the Gemara says this exact distinction, that when do we say the concept of Migu, that whatever status it had when Shabbos enters, that's the status it keeps, that's when it's left alone. That's when, as the Gemara puts it, Shemayim, that's when heaven makes it different, changes its status. The thing happened to have dried, or the apple happened to have fallen, you know, happened to have fallen on Friday night. That's not you involved, that's Hashem involved, so to speak. That is off limits. But if you, the person, is the one who has set it up before Shabbos to change, and then it does go ahead and change on Shabbos, that's perfectly fine. So the Gemara says, food, in our case, cholent, which was not edible at sunset on Friday afternoon, is certainly not, is edible, is okay, is not Muksa, Shabbos day. And the way the commentaries explain this is very simple. The whole concept of Muksa is Hesach Hadas, the idea that you're no, it's out of sight, out of mind, right? Your cell phone is out of your mind on Shabbos, and therefore you can't move it. Because if you're going into Shabbos, it's not something you're planning on using. So the apple on the tree at sunset Friday afternoon is out of your mind. You're not planning on eating that apple because it's still connected to the tree. You're not allowed to pluck it from the tree on Shabbos, which again is a melacha we'll get to later. But the cholent, you set up before Shabbos to become edible on Shabbos. That's not out of mind. That's the opposite. You set it up specifically to eat on Shabbos. Okay. So I don't want to get, I think one of the points of confusion was the specifics around cooking on Shabbos and how to go into Shabbos and how to make sure that the food going into Shabbos is, let me just finish this thought and I'll take your question, is, you know, it doesn't have to be fully cooked before Shabbos. This is a big, big topic. We'll spend several months on the topic of cooking when we get there. Let me just say very briefly in short, there are two approaches to putting up a cholent Friday afternoon. One approach, the strictest approach, is that everything should be cooked before Shabbos, fully cooked, and the, again, without getting into blech and covering the fire and all that, but certainly the controls should be covered, disabled, taped, foiled over, something like that, before Shabbos starts. So that's the strictest approach, so that, again, the food is fully cooked, and the way that you would normally interact with that food is, you know, there's a sign there somehow making sure that you're not going to play with it on Shabbos. So in a crock pot, which is the most common usage today, the stricter approach would say, put that cholent up early enough so that it's fully cooked before Shabbos, and cover the knob, take off the knob, tape the knob, do something to the knob so that no one plays with it. That is the strictest approach. It's certainly mentioned in the postgame. The halakha does not require that. The strict letter of the law does not require that, which is why many of us, I suspect many of you here in the room, will put up a cholent right before Shabbos, which means the meat is raw, the potatoes are raw, the beans are inedible, and the only requirement the halakha places on this would be to tape the knob or to remove the knob, and even that is not 100% clear. Many opinions hold, again, for reasons I don't want to get into right this second, you don't even have to do that. So there are different approaches, and they're both certainly acceptable and justified, and both are done within the Jewish world. But certainly the second approach is, I suspect in our world, is the more common approach. And I discussed it again with Rabbi Kushkerman last week. I'm sure many of you know, Sephardi Posek, Sephardi Rav, lives in Tocco Hills. And when my wife and I got married, I asked this shiloh to one of the poskim in Baltimore, and that's what he told us to do. So it's a widely held approach that you can put the challah up right before Shabbos, as long as you tape it down or cover it or whatever it is. That's perfectly fine. So I'm happy to take questions, even though I don't want to get too far into Bishul. Have a question?
I have a question. Well, we actually have a question.
Okay.
About the tshuva.
Yeah.
So, is that okay? I want to just understand. Is that okay to put a raw ingredient right before Shabbat? It has to be like half an hour before Shabbat, 1 hour, 4 hours, 6 hours.
Right. So, yeah, this gets very sticky, to say the least. Again, the strictest of opinions would say fully cooked is the way to go. Which, in a slow cooker, in a crock pot, would be, I suspect, especially if there's meat in there, would probably be 4 or 5, 6 hours. I mean, a long time. I mean, you're putting it up noon to be ready for 5:30 Shabbos. Everyone should ask their local Orthodox rabbi, but that's not required. I mean, there's a custom. It's mentioned in one of the most important halachos farim. One of the most important halachos farim is the Shmir Shabbos Kel Chasa, which the author, I believe, is still living, and he, his guidance comes from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who's one of the greatest of the great. That's the approach that he suggests today. But again, many posts can disagree with that, and they say you can put it up any time you want. You can put it up 5 minutes before Shabbos, half an hour. I mean, it's irrelevant as long as you tape the knob. So the answer to your question is yes. You can put up 6 hours. You can put it up. There's really, it's more of a stringency to put it up earlier than halacha. Say again.
So can it be 5 minutes before Shabbos?
You can put it up. The halacha itself requires exactly allows you to put it up right before Shabbos. Yeah.
Turn
it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we're talking about a crock pot that needs to cook for 4 or 5, 6 hours so it's edible. You put it up, let's say, 5 o'clock Friday afternoon, and you go and you cover the knobs, you light the Shabbos candles. It won't be ready till 11 p.m. and it'll be delicious by 1 o'clock when you get home. And of course, it's on the whole time. You unplug it, no Shabbos. That's perfectly fine. Again, I don't want to get too far into Hilchos Bishul because there's so much here that we haven't touched on. But just as what to do with the Shabbos, those are the two approaches. Okay, I hope that clarifies more than it muddies. Now, there is also a topic, ladies, I realized going through my notes that we touched on but not in enough depth. And that is, in category B, we talked about partial muksa. This is really going back to page 1, the bottom of page 1. We said that certain objects, we talked about a hammer as an example, we talked about a pen as an example, we labeled them as partially muksa category B. And we mentioned, very briefly, that there are certain circumstances where you're allowed to move those objects. And again, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't recall really clarifying that properly and sufficiently. The two leniencies are if you need the object itself for a permissible purpose, so that a pen, as we mentioned earlier, you can use as a back scratcher, even though the pen is a B. It's a category B. It's always a pen. There's no dual uses going on here. The pen is a B. There's no question about it. It's partially muksa. You're not allowed to move it. If, at the same time, you need that pen for something else, or in our other example, you need a hammer to crack open nuts, even though you never do that. If you need it, and that's all you've got, you just can't reach that spot on your back, and that pen is just sitting there, and you don't have a back scratcher, or anyone that can help you, that you're allowed to use that pen. That pen is permissible, even though it's a B, but B has those leniencies. It's partially muksa in the sense that there are certain things you're allowed to do with it. Okay? So, again, you can make your B into an A. The hammer can be a nutcracker, or it could be a dual purpose. Here we're talking even, the point I want to make here and clarify is, even if the B is really a B, 100% a B, But if you're using it for a purpose that is permissible in Shabbos, and there's nothing else around to use, you're allowed to use that bee. That's the first leniency. The second leniency, ladies, is if you need the spot that it's in, if you need the place that it's in, someone left the, let's avoid cell phones here, someone left a hammer, I don't know, on the kitchen table. the markers, the crayons, you know, something like that, which most of us, I think, would categorize as bees. So it's on the Shabbos table, and you need to set the table for Shabbos for the meal. You'll have to pick those up and move them somewhere else, because they are category bees. They're kalim. They're designed for a prohibited Shabbos purpose. You're willing to use them for something else, meaning in particular, you're not that pack of pens is nothing special to you. You are allowed to pick it up and move it somewhere else to get it out of the way. So the two things again are A, no letters. Number one, a category B, number one would be if you need this for permissible use and you have nothing else to use, you're allowed to use it. And number two is if you need the place that muksa item category B is, you're allowed to move it away from that place. Those are really only two, only two reasons you're allowed to move that object. So, and we're going to learn a couple other leniencies in a moment. You see that there are quite a few leniencies in the laws of Muksa. Okay, so that was just another point that I wanted to make sure we clarified. One other point, again, going back to the first class, I'm not sure if it was clear about this or not. The definition of Muksa, you recall, is moving objects. The laws of Muksa do not prohibit touching objects, which is why, for example, you can touch a car. You can touch anything which won't move necessarily by touching it. There is no Isser Muksa. The prohibition of Muksa does not apply. I mean, if you get behind the car and start pushing it, yeah, that's Muksa, and there's probably other issues going on there too. But, a pen, for example, it's very hard to touch a pen without moving it, obviously. So sometimes there are one and the same, but technically speaking, the prohibition of muksa is strictly moving objects, has nothing to do with touching those objects. Chazal, the rabbis, did not prohibit touching these types of objects. All right. So again, just wanted to clarify that point.
So the moving objects that have no purpose for Shabbos,
that's the definition? That's exactly. That's the definition of muksa, is moving those objects. Okay, so if I'm not mistaken, we are top of page 3, number 7, which is Bussis. Okay. Now, Bussis, in the Hebrew language, is Beis Samech Yod Samech. Beis Samech Yod Samech is Bussis. And Bussis is, interestingly enough, related to the English word base, basis. A Bussis is a base, meaning is one object that is holding up another. One object that is holding another. So the halacha tells us that if muksa, category B or category C, is on something, that something becomes muksa. No, I don't. Sorry. I should make note that the sheets are, I didn't check, I meant to check today, but I didn't check. They are online? Okay, so the sheets are online and are printable on online. So that bus is, ladies, the object underneath, the base, the thing that's holding up the muksa, takes on the halacha of the muksa. The base takes on the halachos of the muksa, which is on top of it. So, for example, if your smartphone is on a table, that table becomes a smartphone. That table becomes muksa. Let's assume category C, laptop, again, anything that you're really particular about would become, the table would become a C. If it's a hammer, pen, something like that, then the base would become a B. So whatever the definition here of the bustus is, whatever is holding up the muksa, is serving the muksa, so to speak, that becomes muksa as well. Now there's an important caveat to this, which is, it only becomes muksa if you intended for it to be there, intended, like underlined three times, if you intended it for it to be there, sunset Friday night. If you intended for that muksa item to be there, like that's where it is, the computer on the computer table. The computer table has a halacha of a basis, it's the base to the computer, so that table is no longer a table in the eyes of halacha, it's a computer. Etc., etc., etc. Drawers, for example, are very common basis. If you stash all your stuff, your cash, your wallet, your phone, your whatever it is in a particular drawer, well that drawer, and again we'll see some other details here in a moment, but that drawer generally becomes muksa. It becomes a basis to that object. Okay, so hold questions please for 2 minutes and we'll get some questions in. So that's true, ladies, even if the muksa is somehow removed, which we'll talk about a little bit more, but even if the muksa item is removed, the basis remains muksa, because this follows the same concept before of migu, which tells us that whatever status something had going into Shabbos is a status that it retains the whole Shabbos. So even if those objects were somehow removed, a kid took them off, a non-Jew took them off, someone somehow or other, the wind blew it off, that doesn't make a difference. The item remains muksa as it was when it went into Shabbos, again with the caveat that it was left there on purpose. So that if your phone was left on the dining room table by accident, that doesn't make the dining room table muksa. It was there by accident. If, the long list of examples does not affect the status of the base unless you meant to leave it there. Unless it's there on purpose, you put it there on purpose. Okay. Now, before we move on to 8, we've got one more point here, and that is, what happens if there are multiple items on the table, multiple items on the bed, multiple items on the, on the dining room table? Which one carries the day? So here the halakha is quite lenient and says whatever is needed for Shabbos is the more important item. Whatever item is needed for Shabbos is the more important item. So, classic example, you've got a drawer, and in the drawer is a sitter, which costs you, 15, 20 bucks, and in the drawer is a smartphone, in the drawer is a significant amount of cash, in the drawer is something much more valuable, objectively, but that sitter carries the day. That drawer is considered a base to both the sitter and to the cash, but the sitter is what you need on Shabbos. That means the drawer is really halachically a sitter. The drawer remains not muksa because it's a basis to both. If the sitter wasn't there going into Shabbos and the only thing there were valuables, then that drawer would be muksa. You would not be able to open that drawer. But if it's a base, if it's supporting, if it's holding up multiple items, and one of them is needed for Shabbos, which, let's face it, that's generally speaking why you're going to be opening the drawer in the first place, because it's something in that you need on Shabbos. So then that item, even if they were both intentionally left there going into Shabbos, that drawer is not muksa, because it's a basis to both. Okay, now, 2 more points, and then we'll take questions. So again, if there's multiple items, we follow the item which is used on Shabbos is considered the dominant, the more important item, and that's what the halacha, that item, the table, chair, bed, whatever it is, follows the status of the needed item and not the other, maybe even more valuable items. Okay, 8. The owner of the lower item is in charge. Very similar to the issue we discussed earlier. You can't willy-nilly go around and start making other people's tables muksa. You can't do that. You can't just take your muksa items and start, you can imagine a 10-year-old doing this. Start taking muksa items and distributing them around their sister, brother's stuff, and you can't sleep on your bed because I left my fill-in-the-blank on your bed. That doesn't work. You have to have rights to the item, to the base, in order to make it muksa. You can't forbid something of someone else's by doing that. That simply does not work. So you have to be the owner of the lower item in order to make it a basis. You have to be the owner of that lower item in order to make it a basis. Okay, and then one more topic under this heading, which is kids. What about a kid who's holding muksa? You got a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old holding muksa. And you need to pick them up and carry them off to wherever they need to be next. So what do you do then? Because in a certain sense, if you think about it, they're holding the muksa, which doesn't really make them a busis, because you didn't intend for that. They're simply not a busis. A person cannot become a busis. But by moving them, you're moving the muksa. What do you do? So here the halacha says you try. This is the way we deal with many of these types of issues. You try your best to get the kid to let go. You cajole, you be patient, you do whatever you need to do to try to convince, to prevail upon the 3-year-old to put the muksa down. And this is especially true if it's valuable. I try and convince the child to put the muksa down. If it really proves to be impossible, then you certainly can pick up the child and move them on. Obviously, it goes without saying, we're not talking about a dangerous situation or anything like that. But you need to go to shul, and they're walking around with the. That's a situation where you do your best to get them to put it down so that you're not moving them, which is moving the muksa. But if you're stuck, then you're certainly allowed to move pick up the child. And if they drop it, they drop it. Obviously, you can't pick it up after they drop it. But that's an approach we take in many different areas where kids are involved in that way. Okay, questions on what we said? Yeah.
Okay, I had one question, but I think you answered this. I have a TV on the dresser. I could go in the drawer if I need it for Shabbos, right?
The drawer in that cabinet would not be muksa, correct?
And then what if I have a coffee maker on my counter?
Good question. So you're asking, can you move, let's say, a counter on wheels or something?
Can I?
You can definitely use the counter, yes. Anything which is part of a building, a door, whatever, cannot become muksa. Uh-huh. Anything which is connected to the ground is not muksa at all. So you have an umbrella or something, the umbrella would be category B, let's say, hanging on the door handle. The door cannot become muksa. Doesn't work. Your purse is hanging on door handle. Does not become muksa.
But you can still touch the surface. So if you have a table and you left your cell phone on the table, the table itself is muksa, but then if you are having a cup of tea, you can still put your cup.
For sure, yes. Yes. This will go back to what we said. You cannot move that table. You can certainly use the rest of it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that's only if you intended to leave the muksa on there, before Shabbos. Yes, ma'am.
If you convince the child to drop the muksa, and they happen to drop it in a place where it could be stepped on, tripped on, whatever, do you then kick it or move it?
Okay, so that actually gets us to the next topic. That's the segue to the next topic, which is, well, how do you get around muksa? Right? There are certain ways. Chazal made a long list of rules and regs for muksa, but there also happens to be, exactly exhibit A, there happens to be several very easy ways to get around the laws of muksa. And I do not advise using these willy-nilly. I think I mentioned the story of my son with the pen, first class.
Yeah,
okay. So that's an example of going a little too far with these leniencies. But let's go through these. Number 10, ladies, you find yourself holding muksa. Okay, so this isn't exactly speaking to your question first, but if you find yourself holding muksa, you picked up something and you realize, oh my gosh, I shouldn't be holding this. So then the rules depend on what kind of muksa it is. Again, there's two basic kinds. There's going to be B, which is partially muksa, and C, which is totally muksa. So here the halacha says, if you accidentally somehow or other got B in your hand, muksa category B in your hands, you are then allowed to put it down wherever you want. Once you've got it, you don't have to drop it. You can move it to wherever you want to move it to, safe and sound, even if it's just a question of it's not going to hurt anybody, but it's going to get damaged or dented or whatever. You're allowed to move it. You're not allowed to pick it up for that purpose. But once you've got it somehow, how you got it at this point is not important, but it's in your hands. You realize, oh my gosh, you can bring it wherever you want. C, on the other hand, we do take a much stricter view. C, we basically say, freeze and drop it. We basically say, get it out of your hands as fast as possible. Now, again, obviously, common sense would rule over here. The halacha does not want you dropping glass pitcher, smashing it all over the floor, that type of thing. Obviously, it's going to be dangerous. Don't just drop it. Put it down safely. But generally speaking, we all understand, I think, what to do. We need to get our hands off of it ASAP. So halacha does take a different approach depending on what you're holding. Now, the answer you've all been waiting for is really number 11 and 12. And that is, number 11 is indirectly moving items with your hands. So this is a very important leniency. So there's two parts to this. There's, bullet point number one and bullet point number two. One of them is simply tilting something which is not muksa to get the muksa off. So that someone left a hammer on a pillow. So the best thing to do in that scenario is, and it wasn't left there on purpose, the pillow is not a boxis, the best thing there is simply to lift up the pillow and have the muksa fall onto the ground. That is indirectly moving the muksa with your hands. You're using your hands, and the focus here is moving things with your hands. You're using your hands, but your hands are interacting with the non-muksa, and you're moving the muksa. That is the best way to deal with that particular situation, is to tilt off the muksa by moving the non-muksa. That's bullet point number one. Number two is, as we were just demonstrated a moment ago, is using the back of your hand, or some, let's say back of your hand for now, to move the muksa away, so that even, let's say, a smartphone, let's assume it's a C, if you can use the back of your hand, the Gemara calls it kol'ach hayad, which literally means the back of your hand. If you can do that with the item, you are, in fact, allowed to move it, even if it's C. You're allowed to move it without the palms of your hands, without, the regular, normal way of moving things. You can use the back of your hands to move that item away. And there's, the only requirement here would be that you need to do it for Shabbos. There's no, long list of rules. You need the space. You need it for something. As long as you're using the back of your hands and not the front of your hands, you can move just about anything for any Shabbos purpose. And then 12, ladies, moving an item without your hands. So this is kicking. This is elbows. This is moving with your side. Anything which is not, that's perfectly fine. To move muksa items. And you say this, and this is where people usually faint. But to move muksa items on Shabbos, as long as you don't use your hands, is perfectly fine. Chazal did not forbid that type of moving of items. Again, not willy-nilly, not arbitrary, one should not engender a light attitude towards muksa. But the facts are the facts. Chazal only, the rabbis only forbade moving muksa items with your hands or in a normative way. I guess we could come up with cases where it's muksa, the normative way is with your foot, and that would be a problem. I'm sure we can come up with something like that. But generally speaking, other parts of your body, to move something is perfectly permissible. Okay, 13 dangerous items. We've touched on this already. It is not only permissible, but it is really incumbent and required for us to move muksa items, which are dangerous for whatever reason, out of harm's way. That's a requirement, that's a responsibility of anyone that can dispense with that to do so, mitzvah in the Torah, to protect our health, and that is certainly part of it. Once the item gets to where it needs to go, it's safe and it's sound. The example before we gave was pieces of glass. It is muksa. This is not a dispensation to do whatever you want with it. It's a dispensation to move it out of the way so that no one gets hurt. Glass or any object really that's truly dangerous can be moved even with your hands to get it out of the way. Okay, and then the last point on this page, ladies, number 14, repugnant, smelly stuff. Dirty diaper comes to mind, even though that would normally be muksa, garbage, all these types of things certainly don't have a normative Shabbos purpose, but to very similar to dangerous items, you're allowed to move them to get them out of, out of people's way, out of smelling distance or whatever it is. You can mat them up, throw them out, bring them outside, whatever you normally would do with that type of smelly, gross item,
The halacha, hilchos muksa, allows for that to happen. Once they are there, they of course are muksa. You can't just move the garbage cans around. That's no. Once they're out of your domicile, once it's out of your whiff range, you are not allowed to move it anymore. It becomes muksa as it was before. Okay, questions? Yes, ma'am.
What if you're walking the shoals and you're wearing a jacket that you haven't worn in a while, and you get down the pocket and you realize that there's sun?
Good question. That's one of the famous questions. Okay, so we're going to assume you live in an area which, thank God, is very common these days, with an Eruv, which I assume is the basis of your question. You're not talking at all about the issue of carrying from one domain to another, which I want to leave for another time. You're talking about walking around Tillion Mill Road, where we have an Eruv, thank God, and you find muksa in your pockets. The only issue at hand is the muksa issue. So in that case, ladies, the best thing would be to, as we said before, to tilt it out of your pocket, if you can, and leave it on the side of the street, leave it on the sidewalk, etc. Even if it's money. I'd have to really look into this, how far the halacha requires one to do that, because at the end of the day, you're not typically moving it with your hands. You're moving it, another way. But I am, let me double check that halacha, because I'm not 100% sure. Yes, ma'am. Yes. That has to do very much with the issue that we tried getting rid of earlier, which is moving things from one domain to another. So what Mrs. Freeman is raising is that if you have something in your pocket and you're outside of an Eruv, then you really should, in most cases, you should turn around and go back to where you came from and not stop. That's nothing to do with muksa, that has to do with carrying. So I have to double check and make sure I'm not confusing one set of rules with the other. Let me get back to you next time. Okay, other questions? Yes, ma'am.
The danger issue. We talked about glass. What about fire?
What do you mean?
What I mean directly is that I have heard that if a fire starts from candles, there should be no other fire going in your house.
Right.
That you watch your house burn down.
Have you been speaking to Salt Woman? Every time Rabbi Freeman discusses this Mishnah, he goes crazy. Okay, so the every year when I was teaching, the girls had to suffer through. It didn't make a difference. They were ninth graders and just having me for the first time, or 12th graders, and they were already heard the speech many times. But every year, when we discuss those halachos and Chanukah, which is very common, and Pesach for B'dikas Chametz, I gave the same speech, which is that the Gemara says Chamira Sakanta Misura, which means that danger is even more severe and more strict than the halacha, which means the halacha mandates that we make sure that we're safe and sound, so that one is not allowed ever to do something which is dangerous, which obviously affects how you set up your Hanukkah candles, how you do your B'dikas Chametz, all these types of things. The halacha is very, very clear that if anyone's life is ever in danger, one is required, as we said before with Muksa, to take care of it one way or the other. The Mishnah, the concept that you're referring to, says that if, theoretically, there is there's no potential loss of life or limb or danger to anyone, then the putting out of the fire on Shabbos is prohibited if the only goal really is to save property. Halacha does not bend in front of financial loss. It does certainly bend, no question about it, in front of health and, God forbid, danger. So for all practical purposes, there's no such thing as a fire burning out of control in a home, in any environment that I know of, that isn't dangerous. There's no such thing, especially in the drought-stricken, There's no question about it. There's a mitzvah to put it out. How one puts it out if they've got, you know, their head has gone straight and they can put it out. There's better ways on Shabbos to extinguish it as opposed to less better ways on Shabbos to extinguish it. But there's no question that twice I've been at a Shabbos table, once in a sukkah and once just at a home, where the licht fell over and caught the tablecloth. And that is clearly, without question, a very dangerous situation. So again, if one is calm, cool, and collect, there are better ways of putting that out. If one's not calm, cool, and collect, you do whatever needs to be done, like you would do on a Wednesday. But I had a student whose licht, the light candles are burning in the sukkah, and it was out of control, burning out of control. The father happened to have gotten up in the middle of the night and smelt it and put it out. I mean, the house almost burnt down. So there was no question that the halacha requires one to do whatever is necessary to desecrate the Shabbos to save a life. Again, that's the halacha is making the point that to simply save your house, to simply save money, is not a dispensation for the halacha.
So can you get help to put out this fire?
Yes.
By breaking Shabbos?
Well, again, practically speaking, there's no such thing as a fire that's not dangerous. So you do whatever needs to be done, whether that means calling 911 or a fire extinguisher, or, you know, again, there's, when we get there, we'll discuss the best ways of putting this out and the least. But, you know, I cannot think of a case in our environment at all, anywhere, ever, that it's not dangerous. Fire bring out control.
A little, we had a carriage next to a table, and the kid pulled the table.
Hmm.
The carriage.
Yes.
And
very.
Yeah, we put them to the hospital.
Yes. Very, very dangerous. Okay, we're running out of time. I just want to take questions quickly. Yes, ma'am. Moving pets? Oh, yes. Great question we didn't touch on. Muksa. A pet is muksa. Despite the fact that you and I might think that what's the difference between a cat and a stuffed animal, and I've asked this question and pondered this question. I don't mean, you know, but I mean for our purposes, when the Gemara talks, just very briefly, I maybe came out the wrong way, but in our world, a cat is a pet. A cat is a toy. A cat is something that is there for friendship. It's certainly not something that we associate with work or non-Shabbos activity, etc. Despite that fact, this question was famously asked for Moshe Feinstein, and he ruled unequivocally, and this ruling has stuck, that pets are in fact muksa. So you certainly can feed a pet. You certainly are required to feed pets on Shabbos. But you're not allowed to move the pet. So if the cat jumps in your lap, you know, you can...
I would turn your own pet fine to somebody else's pet.
That has to do with feeding them. You can feed any domesticated animal, yours or others, someone else's. But all animals, yours or someone else's, are muksa. So feeding is totally fine, domesticated. Moving them, picking them up, moving them is in fact not. Okay, last question on Shabbos, Mrs. Glassman. Again, in our environment, there's no such thing. No, we assume that every fire that's not controlled fire is dangerous to life and limb, and you put it out. We'll discuss in more detail how you put it out. But there's no question that it should be put out. Okay. If you intended for the pen to be there, the pen does become muksa. If you did not intend for that pen to be there, it is not muksa. Depends on your attention. Yeah. Yeah, you're allowed to take that garbage bag out because it's going to get smelly and repugnant, etc. You know, it's wherever you normally would put it. Wherever you normally bring it to, that's perfectly fine. We'll get there. It can't make a permanent tie, no.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.